Thanks for joining us. I'm Katty Kay of the BBC, sitting in for Diane Rehm. US-Pakistan relations sour after the dramatic raid on Osama bin Laden's compound. US lawmakers demand to know if Pakistan knew that al-Qaeda leader was living within its borders. The US calls for using frozen Libyan assets to aid rebels fighting to overthrow Muammar Gaddafi. Syria arrests hundreds in a Damascus suburb, and Bahrain targets doctors and nurses who treated injured protesters. Joining me in the studio to discuss the week's top international stories on the Friday News Roundup, James Kitfield of National Journal magazine, Jill Doherty of CNN, and Abdurrahim Fukara of Al Jazeera Arabic. Thank you all so much for coming in.
Good to be here.
The phone number here is 1-800-433-8850. The email address is drshow@wamu.org. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter as well. We will be taking your calls and your questions later on in the programme, but let's start. Wow, what a busy week. Another busy week. We had the first new roundup news hour on domestic news, also very busy and, of course, dominated on the political side by the news of Osama bin Laden's death. Now, of course, more on that. And Jill, what's the latest that we know from the assassination? What happened? What's the fallout been? All the latest details.
Well, you know, the very latest, as I was out in the entrance hall there, was now al-Qaeda has said that they are confirming that he was killed, and they are saying you should not mistreat the body or bodies of anybody else who was killed. But interestingly, they say that Osama bin Laden recorded a message a week before he died, and this was on what's being referred to as Arab Spring, but these, Arab uprisings, and that this will shortly or soon be released. So I think that's very intriguing because this it's a larger question, but this Arab revolution, the revolutions sweeping many countries, are very much one of the issues that we'll be looking at going forward in the implications of Osama bin Laden's killing.
Well, Abdurrahim, what does that news about the al-Qaeda website putting up a confirmation that bin Laden has been killed, what does that do to doubters who might have said, we don't believe it, we think that this is misinformation coming out of the American government? Does it change any minds, do you think?
Well, I mean, first of all, there are still a lot of people going around saying that information still needs to be verified. But I think the simple fact that we have reports of al-Qaeda confirming the death of Osama bin Laden is obviously very significant. It's very significant for a particular segment of public opinion in that part of the world, especially in places like Pakistan and Afghanistan, in that it provides confirmation of the closure that Osama bin Laden is dead. Remember that after 9/11, there were a lot of people throughout the Muslim world who doubted that he had anything to do with 9/11, and certainly subsequently who doubted that he was still alive. People were wondering how many decades does it take a superpower like the United States to track down one man in a specific geographical area. The fact that now we have these reports confirming his death, I think, will play to that particular audience, confirming that he's dead.
And James, this morning the US carried out the first drone attack inside Pakistan since bin Laden's death. It killed 10 people in this attack. Are we going to start seeing, because of the intelligence cache that was taken from bin Laden's compound, do you think we are going to see now a rash of strikes against other al-Qaeda leaders who might have come out from that, whose names might have come out from that intelligence cache?
Well, certainly I think that's the hope. I think that, you know, they're going to be very careful right now. This has obviously ruptured U.S.-Pakistan relations in the short term. So they're going to be careful about trying to find, the uneasy even keel that exists between us and Pakistan. Right now, it's almost a rupture in relationships. But they have all this intelligence, and I think, especially if they have intelligence on the number two, Zawahiri, they will probably be looking to sort of gain even more momentum. I mean, I think that they see, and I've talked to White House officials who sort of confirm this to me, that they see a possibility here to really put an end to, quote unquote, the mindset of the war on terror, that the Al-Qaeda is this organization that is constantly fed by legions of new jihadists who want to wage war with the West, you know, at the inspiration of Osama bin Laden. You know, he's been revealed as one man whose message was already losing a lot of power.
We saw Al-Qaeda's poll numbers in the Middle East, for example, declining quite dramatically over the last few years.
Right. And, you know, as has already been said, the Arab Spring was really a refutation of his whole dialogue and narrative. And, you know, the Arab world shrugged at the news that Osama bin Laden was dead, you know, much different from the reaction in America, which was really an interesting sort of dichotomy. I think that's also important because it suggests that America needed a sort of closure on this, in a sense, and they may be able to get it. Ever since coming into office, the Obama administration has trying to been sort of widening the prism of our foreign and national security policy beyond just the war on terror. That phrase has been dropped by this administration. Even Bush, in his last, you know, months of his term, had sort of tried to move beyond that. This shows every sign of possibly helping us do that.
We had other nuggets of intelligence that are coming out from that compound, Jill, in the form of interviews with some of the women that were there, particularly the wife, the young wife who was in the room with Osama bin Laden. I thought some of the things that she has been saying, allegedly to Pakistani police, were interesting.
One of them being that she and I'm not quite sure whether we pin it down as Osama bin Laden himself, but that she was in that room, and presumably he was, for probably 5 or 6 years. Never coming out.
Effectively under house arrest, self-imposed house arrest.
Yes, which, you know, speaks to a lot of discipline in terms of how
and
he
paranoia,
stay there.
I guess, about of fear of, you know, of somebody having reprisals.
Yeah, is it paranoia when they actually are after you, though?
he was probably exactly right not to leave that room. But she also said, I think, that there had been splits within Al-Qaeda and that the organization was having financial problems.
Yes, especially Osama bin Laden himself. His faction was having, we understand, financial problems, and that led to a split. And, you know, that I think that's very important, you know, to James' point, that Al-Qaeda already was losing steam. And as I look at this event, you know, so huge, it feels as if it's happening in a different world, you know, the different world certainly from 10 years ago and even just a few years ago, because the revolutions that are going on have really transformed and have been an expression of a transformation in that part of the world. I was looking, for example, we were looking at, CNN was looking at some of the social media response to the death of bin Laden, and they're saying bin Laden, dead or alive, no longer matters, and that Al-Qaeda's ideology and Islamism in general have been marginalized by these protests, and that also these protests are a great source of pride for young people. So there's a very different dynamic going on, I think, in the region.
Abdurrahim, what do you make of the reaction in the Middle East? I mean, very interesting. Al Jazeera Arabic, of course, must have been reporting this and monitoring reaction. And we did have, you know, the kinds of reactions from some leaders, for example, of Hamas, of the Muslim Brotherhood, that you might expect.
Yes.
But actually, the general reaction, did that surprise you?
Well,
The general lack of reaction.
The general lack of
reaction,
to a limited degree only. I think that the irony that both James and Jill were talking about, that there has been actually far more attention given to the event in the United States than there has been in that part of the Muslim world, the Arab world, is really interesting. And I think it's just testimony to the fact that people have decided in that part of the world that they want to move on. But having said that, there is obviously a very compelling overlap between the narrative of bin Laden and the narrative of young people who've led these demonstrations for democracy and freedom in the Middle East.
Which is
that he wanted to get rid of rulers like Mubarak or bin Ali, and he saw them as lackeys of the West, carrying out agendas of the West against the interests of their own people. And I think these demonstrations, these revolutions in the Middle East, they've obviously toppled Mubarak, they've toppled Zine al-Abidine bin Ali in Tunisia. But I think that's where the overlap stops, because during the demonstrations, the protests in Tunisia, in Egypt, even now in Syria, we're not hearing any anti-West slogans. These are done, at least at this particular point in time, for purely local reasons, freedom and democracy for people in
and of course, totally different in the method that they're
totally
using.
Different.
These are peaceful protests,
at least in Tunisia and Egypt.
Okay,
can I just add to that too? That I mean, that is absolutely a fundamental difference that really gets to the point that we're all three making here. Is that what you saw in the Arab Spring? You know, Bin Laden wanted to lead the new generation of youth to this, to topple the dictators, but then to install a 7th century fundamentalist Islamic caliphate. And what the Arab Spring showed is that is not the aspirations of the young Muslims and Arabs in the Arab world now. And that is what I'm when I say that it's sort of the end of Bin Laden as this inspirational figure that at one point and 5 years ago had more approval rating in the Muslim world than America. It's a spent force, I think.
Jill, let's talk a little bit more, and James raised it earlier, of course, the big question raised about relations with Pakistan going forward. What are the Pakistanis saying at the end of this week about Bin Laden being killed?
Well, they're
so
obviously
close to this
very
base.
Angry, and this came out, I think you'd have to go back probably to Panetta's statement, Leon Panetta, head of the CIA, his statements quoted from testimony on Capitol Hill in which he said that if you look at the fact that Osama bin Laden was in that compound for that time, how could he have been there? And he said the Pakistani officials were either involved or incompetent. Well, of course, that did not go over well in Pakistan. And so you have General Kayani saying, yes, there might have been some type of issue with how we handle this, but that any type of repeat of what we are seeing, which is, he would argue, a violation of the sovereignty of Pakistan, will call into question this entire relationship, review of the military and intelligence cooperation. And then you also have this juggernaut on Capitol Hill. I don't know how long it will last. I'd be interested in your views, gentlemen. But the juggernaut for funding, cutting funding.
And we'll have more on the relationship with Pakistan after the killing of Osama bin Laden in the International Hour of the Friday News Roundup. Stay with us. Welcome back. I'm Caddy Kay of the BBC. You've joined the International Hour of the Friday News Roundup. I have in the studio with me James Kitfield of the National Journal. Jill Doherty of CNN is here. Abdurrahim Fukara of Al Jazeera Arabic is also here. We will be opening the phones in just a while. 1-800-433-8850 is our phone number. drshow@wmu.org. is the email address, and of course you can find us on Facebook and Twitter as well. Just before the break, we were talking about relations between Pakistan and America in the light of this killing. And one of the things that kind of has struck me during the course of the week, actually, James, is just how careful the White House has been in its language when it talks about Pakistan, whilst raising suspicions, as Leon Panetta has done, about, incredulity, really, about whether the Pakistanis could have had bin Laden so close to their military base without knowing about it, but also wanting to give the Pakistanis credit for what they have done in terms of their actions against al-Qaeda leaders and against extremist leaders. So kind of trying to tread this fine line of not pushing Pakistan totally away, because that's really a position America can't afford.
Right. Anyone who's dealt with this, and especially who's dealt with it from inside any administration, but certainly the last two, the Bush and the Obama administrations, knows you can't walk away from the Pakistani relationship. It's impossible. They are too big to fail, and they are the home of a really witch's brew of extremist groups. They have a nuclear arsenal that we have to worry about if we don't
want to end up in a relationship with Pakistan like the relationship we have with Iran. For example.
Exactly. And this is a very key point. You know, we really hope that this will help facilitate reconciliation talks with the Taliban next door in Afghanistan. Pakistan is key to that in the whole discussion. They are the benefactors in many ways of the Taliban, of the Afghan Taliban. That's key. We have a July deadline coming up when we're going to announce some withdrawal of U.S. troops. They're going to the administration hopes to announce fairly significant withdrawal. So this is a very key time in the whole Afghan war. Pakistan is absolutely vital to all of those issues. And as I said about the nuclear weapons, if the military is so inept that Osama bin Laden, the most wanted man in history, is living under the noses of the military, then you have to wonder about the security of those nuclear weapons, how competent they are to ensure the security of those nuclear weapons. So for all those reasons, we can't back away from it. But what they really hope to do is use this embarrassment to gain leverage over the Pakistanis, to do some of the hard things we've been asking them to do for a long time, go after some more of these high-value targets, as well as start denying sanctuary to some of these groups like the Haqqani Network and others who are killing American soldiers next door in Afghanistan.
Abdurrahim, in that context, when you have Republicans and Democrats in Congress raising the question of the validity, the justification for American aid to Pakistan, does that help or hinder the relationship going forward?
Well, I think James is right in saying that in the short term, obviously this is a crisis. This is a crisis of confidence. And incidentally, the crisis of confidence, the crisis of credibility in the Muslim world with regard to Osama bin Laden being reportedly killed on Pakistani soil, the perception of lack of credibility extends to both Pakistan and to the United States, because a lot of people in the Muslim world are saying the United States, the superpower that controls the earth, the air, space, investing endless resources, human and financial, in that part of the world, both Afghanistan and Pakistan, and cannot track down one man in Pakistan, give me a break. That's a lot of people are going around saying that, and I think some of them are Pakistanis also repeating that refrain. Now, it seems to me that the relationship, despite the looming crisis between the United States and Pakistan, is a Catholic marriage, or I should say, since Pakistan is part of the Muslim world, it's a Muslim marriage. It's equally difficult to get a divorce in both religions. The Pakistan obviously does need the United States in more ways than one. One of them is financial. Remember that Pakistan feels that it faces a mortal or existential threat from India, and it feels that it needs the support of the United States and others on that front. And the United States, equally, as James said, for the United States, the role of Pakistan in getting any reasonable agreement in Afghanistan is absolutely crucial.
Okay, there is news just coming up being reported by the Associated Press about some of the intelligence that's been found in that compound. And we know that the SEALs, while they were in there, took out hard drives, they took out thumb drives, a whole lot of documents. And the Associated Press talks in reference to the website that's just gone up from al-Qaeda and the announcement that Osama bin Laden has been killed. It writes, "The confirmation came as newly uncovered documents found in bin Laden's residence revealed al-Qaeda plans for derailing an American train on the upcoming 10th anniversary of the September the 11th attacks." I'd heard about the train plots, James, but nothing specific. Could you?
I have not heard specific reference to the train plot. We should not be surprised that al-Qaeda was desperately trying, and they have been desperately trying for 10 years now. We've unfolded and revealed many of these plots. desperately trying to follow up with 9/11 was something that really restored their relevance, because, you know, operationally they were becoming, especially the core in Pakistan, were under such heat from the drone strikes from these manhunts that they operationally were marginalized, and we've seen that time and time again. So they're trying desperately to get back in the game. Certainly the 10th anniversary of 9/11 would be an opportunity. Now with bin Laden's death, they're vowing revenge. So we can, you know, in the short term, the danger from a attack has grown. And I imagine that their affiliates like Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula are also going to try to do something to avenge him. So in the short term, you could probably argue that the terrorist threat has been has grown. And indeed, the FBI has said as much, that they're on sort of wartime alert because they think this will happen.
Jill? You know, I think we have to define exactly what that planning was. I mean, I've heard it described more like jottings on a piece of paper or something. But be that as it may, it still is a very important moment, because the narrative so far was that bin Laden had been, hiding, that he was no longer operationally involved, that he was more a figurehead, an inspirational person. So even if, as James says, he was trying to get back in the game, there is apparently an indication that he was, to some extent, involved operationally, or at least giving some direction.
Okay, I know you and I, Jill, are interested in the fate of the wife who was found. And there, AP again reporting she has been talking to Pakistani intelligence, and they feel that she might be an important source of information about how he managed to avoid capture for so long, because she never left the upper floors of the house the entire time she was there, and that was 5 years. Mm. So quite an extraordinary detail that we're getting again, these kind of amazing details about how Osama bin Laden was living Abdurrahim in these last few years when of course everyone was hunting for him.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, if all these reports that the Pakistanis knew or had an inkling all these years, for him to be, if they were true, for him to be actually to have lived in the eye of the storm for 5 years, it's just absolutely incredible. And then the details about how the household was actually managed inside is also another fascinating aspect of the story. But I think more importantly, especially for the Obama administration narrative about what actually happened, these details coming from inside the household, I think if anything, they sort of shed more light on the doubts and suspicions surrounding that narrative, because initially bin Laden, in the statements that the White House put initially, bin Laden was armed, he put up a fight, he used a woman as a shield, and so on, and all that was subsequently changed. Now, it could be argued that obviously these things happen in the fog of war. But especially if you're addressing an international audience that has been over the last 10 years highly skeptical of anything that the US has done or said about bin Laden, I think that's a potential problem.
James?
I agree with that. I think this has been an absolutely great week for this White House and for this president. And I think he can probably be forgiven a small mistake. But it was a mistake for John Brennan, the counterterrorism head, to get up and suggest that Osama bin Laden was a coward. That fits into their narrative, but it doesn't fit into reality. We know this guy. Of all the things you can say about this guy, he's not a physical coward. And the idea of him grabbing his wife as a shield, and it didn't even ring true. They had to back off of it within 24 hours. It was really clumsy. Probably argued, as your earlier guest said, in your domestic hour, to have gotten your story straight. Because it did make us look ridiculous.
Whilst it might be in the grand scheme of things, a bit of a storm in the teacup, some of the details here in America, of course, as Abdurrahim says, it's very interesting around the world. It's the kind of thing that can be picked up to shed some sort of doubt on.
And it was unnecessary. It was unnecessary. It was an absolutely incredibly well-run operation. No Americans were killed. This guy had, ever since 2001, a wanted dead or alive sign on him anyway. We have, Congress gave the president authorities. We've seen in any number of cases that we drop bombs on these guys, which is a death sentence as well. We don't sit there and ask, are they a threat right there? They have done the deed. They have been, basically, like I said, put a sign of dead and alive on them. And those commandos were within what we consider their rights.
Okay, we're already half past and we've been speaking only about Osama bin Laden. There's a huge amount else that's been happening around the world, of course. And I want to get back to Afghanistan and what the impact of this is on troops in just a moment. But let's quickly talk about another couple of events, because there has been a lot going on in the world, not least in Libya, Jill, where yesterday in Rome, 22 countries got together, agreed to give millions of dollars in aid to the rebels trying to overthrow Muammar Gaddafi. Will that make a difference, that money? And they're also talking now about releasing some of the frozen assets that Libya has.
Right. Secretary Clinton was in Rome at that meeting with allies about Libya, and she is talking about freeing up in some fashion more quickly that $30 billion in frozen assets that the Treasury Department grabbed a while ago. One of the questions I think would be exactly what would this money do? I mean, one of the problems is that you have this opposition, which is not really capable at this point of carrying out the mission, you know, which would be to protect civilians and get rid of Gaddafi. They are not capable at this point of doing it. How long will it take? Will money help to train them? So far, that money...
Will it go to arms?
Well, that was raised there, too. Mm-hmm. You know, Qatar, at that meeting, was talking about that. They put it on the table. I guess it didn't go anyplace. But they already are providing some light arms. But all of this, there's a time factor. I mean, right now we're stuck in the mud and they are not succeeding. So what do you do to help them succeed without transgressing the boundary of that UN resolution and keeping everybody aboard? But you can bet that right now they really want to help as quickly as possible because it's not going well.
I'm Katty Kay. You're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. And if you'd like to join us, do call 1-800-433-8850 or send an email to drshow@wamu.org. Abdurrahim, under the terms of that resolution, and I know this resolution is being debated and what exactly it means to take all necessary measures to protect civilians in Libya, is it possible for the international community to arm the rebels? And would that be the thing after 11 weeks, and now that we're effectively at a stalemate in Libya, that could topple Gaddafi?
Well, I mean, it seems to me that everybody in Libya is in a pickle. Gaddafi is definitely in a pickle because after this, regardless of how long this conflict in Libya goes on, eventually there's no future for his regime in Libya, especially in the current environment in the region mm-hmm. at large. So that's number one. The rebels are definitely in a pickle because, as Jill said, they initially, we were all led to believe that they were within, hop and skip of Tripoli and running over Gaddafi. Turned out that wasn't the case. They do not have the training. They do not have the military capability anytime soon to bring about that kind of change themselves. NATO is definitely in a big pickle. I mean, yes, they have protected civilians. But when you say by any means necessary, a lot of Libyans, a lot of Arabs see the sheer continuation of the Gaddafi regime as a threat to civilians. So they want him gone. But just to go back to Afghanistan, remember that NATO is very, very active in Afghanistan. And the credibility of NATO in Libya, the Afghans, I'm sure, the Taliban, I'm sure, are watching what NATO is doing or not doing in Libya. So, you know, NATO's credibility is on the line. Whatever they can achieve in Libya will have repercussions on their performance in a place like Afghanistan.
And quickly on Syria, where the EU has agreed on an assets freeze and a visa ban for 13 government officials in Syria, but the sanctions will not apply to Syrian President Bashar al-Assad. James, it's been an extraordinary week in Syria. I mean, the pictures coming out, and they're all slightly grainy cell phone videos because it's very difficult for journalists to operate in Syria at the moment, but the pictures that we're coming out of these protesters, unarmed protesters who seem to have lost all fear against one of the most scary regimes in the Middle East and now being attacked by President Assad. What's going on there and what are the chances that this tips in the protesters' direction?
Well, you know, it's a very good question. Syria to me is the next key linchpin because this is a regime and certainly his father had no compunction about killing thousands to stay in power. I must say, I think if you're Assad and you're looking at what's happening in Egypt where Mubarak is now in jail, well, his interior ministry has been convicted and sent to jail. That doesn't really inspire a lot of confidence.
Some of Assad's closest allies are now saying, "Watch the way the wind is blowing here."
Right. So I think that he's in a pickle. But I think he's digging in his heels. And so far, they launched a sort of siege on this town in the south, Daraa, that was really the heartland of the original protest. Killed scores, apparently. Now they're pulling out and saying, job done. We'll see. I doubt it. This is Friday. Friday prayers is usually after Friday prayers is when you see the biggest, demonstrations. It's at a stalemate. There was a time when a lot of people thought that Assad was a reformer. And I was just in Turkey, and certainly the Erdogan government thinks that his instincts are to reform, but that he's been sort of backed into a corner by his the senior generals and security services saying, you got to show a strong hand here. So, I don't think it looks good for him, but there's probably a lot of bloodshed between now and the end of the story.
Jill, are getting reports that security forces are arresting all males over the age of 15 in Daraa.
Oh, it has really gone beyond what it was even just a few days ago. I mean, you have house-to-house arrests, raids, people being taken off. It's brutal. The State Department Secretary Clinton has called it barbaric, alarming. Right now, the question, however, I just want to say on Turkey, losing his best friend is very significant. Prime Minister Erdogan saying it's time for him to step down, that he's no longer committed to whatever he was in reform. That's really significant. I mean, once you get that. But Syria is hugely important in ways that many other countries that we're looking at in that region are not.
Libya, for example.
Exactly.
And unfortunately, it's also important to Iran, which is probably telling him. I mean, it's Iran's conduit to Hezbollah and Hamas, and they're telling him to dig in his heels. And so far, Iran seems to have the argument.
You're listening to the International Now of the Friday News Roundup. We'll be taking your calls just after this short break. 1-800-433-8850. Is the phone number, drshow@wmu.org, an awful lot to get through this week.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live healthy, productive lives at gatesfoundation.org. By the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. And by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age. This is NPR.
Follow me on the funky. Like sipping lemonade.
The Beastie Boys have their first album out in 4 years, called Hot Sauce Committee Part 2. On the next Fresh Air, we hear from the Beastie Boys themselves. Join us.
Welcome back. I'm Katty Kay of the BBC, sitting in for Diane Rehm, and you've joined the International Hour of the Friday News Roundup. The phone number here is 1-800-433-8850. The email address is drshow@wmu.org, and we will go straight to the phones to Richard, who joins us from Haverhill, Massachusetts. Richard, you've joined the Diane Rehm Show.
Yes, thank Caddy. Caddy, I think our forces were told not to take him, not to take Osama bin Laden alive. I think they were told to kill him. And the reason for that, Caddy, can you imagine capturing him and trying him? And where would we keep him as a prisoner? Would we try him in military court? Would we try him in civilian court? We're having a time deciding on the prisoners down in Guantanamo Bay. And also, Caddy, he was an international terrorist. So, you know, he killed people in two countries in Africa, the embassies, in Indonesia, in Spain. So the ICC, the International Criminal Court in The Hague, probably would want also to try him. But the problem with that is that someone like Charles Taylor, he's been, what, on trial for 4 years, and he's still there. And I don't think the American people would have put up with something like that. Could the panel please discuss that, please?
Yeah, Richard, I think that's all really interesting stuff, isn't it, James, about whether they went, those Navy SEALs basically went in with a shoot-to-kill mission. Is that how you read it?
I think that was essentially what it was. Your listener, our listener, raises some very smart points. The last thing they wanted, the Obama administration wanted, was a trial of this guy. That he would hijack that for his propaganda purposes. There would be hostages taken all over the world with the threats to kill them unless we let this guy go. He had sworn that he would not be taken alive, that he was going to go down in martyrdom. But we can't really say, because by the laws of war, and we were fighting this conflict by the laws of war, if someone surrenders, throws their hands up, you cannot execute them. So I think the understanding was that all things being equal, if you have any doubt that he is surrendering, throwing his hands up, and then they'd wonder what to do. I think the assumption was you're going to go in there and he's going to come out dead.
Jill, some people have raised questions about the legality of this, and we actually had the Archbishop of Canterbury in England saying that he felt a bit uncomfortable and that there were questions about the way that this operation was executed and Osama bin Laden was killed when he was unarmed. Is there some legal validity to these questions or not? I mean, are people raising objections when basically, you know, this was the right thing and legally the right thing as well as politically the right thing to do?
Well, I think you have to look at the law of war. If you look at that, the United States would argue that under the law of war internationally, they had the right to respond to somebody who was an imminent threat to the United States. And Osama bin Laden certainly meets those criteria. Now, they had to go into another country to do it. And that gets sticky. Pakistan has said you breached our sovereignty. The United States would say we had to go where this man was because he was going to get somebody or get us one way or the other. The killing itself, I think James is right. I will bet that legally they had everything dotted. I mean, I would presume that they went in with kind of two things. One is, yeah, if he throws up his hands, which he's not going to do, you'll deal with that, but he's not going to. So you are authorized to kill him. But legally they would have to think this through. There's no way that they would just run in and kill him, you know, willy-nilly.
And you won't find that on paper.
No,
I mean, that's
absolutely
the point. There'll be no order to shoot to kill. But the understanding is what I was pointing. I think that's right.
Let's talk a little bit about what this all means for the war in Afghanistan. We've got several listeners writing into us about this. David writes in from Facebook, "If now is not the time to draw down from Afghanistan, when will it be? How many deaths will it take until we know that too many people have died, Jill?"
Well, that reminds me of a song from my years ago. But seriously, I think that it's a false argument. Osama bin Laden doesn't make a lot of difference right now. The war in Afghanistan is going to be winding down, or at least they will begin to pull out troops. That process is underway. What I think is interesting is that the administration now is trying to leverage this to pull over the Taliban and to say, look, the leader is gone. You don't need to be with him anymore. Renounce al-Qaeda. Come over, be part of the political process. That's the hope. And that's where the administration is going. You heard it from Hillary Clinton the day after he was killed.
Chuck writes to us by email, "What did Obama do differently from President Bush that he was able to engage bin Laden within 2 years of taking office?" Abdurrahim, did Obama just get lucky with the intelligence, or was there a specific shift in policy?
Well, I mean, there were possibly points of luck that, you know, nobody can talk about with any degree of authority. But one fundamental difference, obviously, was that Obama came into office saying that Iraq was a war of choice and Afghanistan was a war of necessity, and that President Bush had made a mistake going into Iraq instead of focusing on Afghanistan. So Obama obviously refocused attention on Afghanistan militarily, and it could be argued that, you know, within that realm, he was obviously much more effective in getting Osama bin Laden. Just to go back to the issue of withdrawal, I mean, mm-hmm. to the extent that there are people who think in the United States and throughout the world who think that killing Osama bin Laden is a good thing, well, no good deed goes unpunished. The flip side of the argument now is that, well, if bin Laden is dead, then what are you doing in Afghanistan? You got to get out of Afghanistan. And obviously Obama, as we can see here in the United States, is coming under increasing pressure to contemplate that. There are reasons why I personally think it's going to be very difficult for the U.S. to pull out of Afghanistan. One of them has got to do with the psyche of 9/11 in the United States. The other one has to do with what happened after the Soviets were defeated in Afghanistan and the United States just cut loose, which many people argue that opened the door for Al-Qaeda and bin Laden to get established in Afghanistan. But it's even much more complicated than that, and it harks back to what I said earlier about Pakistan and India. The Pakistanis will not be amenable to helping find an accommodation for the Taliban and for the United States in Afghanistan unless they are absolutely sure that a U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan is not going to undermine the Pakistani position with regard to their nemesis, India.
James.
You know, I actually think that you should look at the hunt for bin Laden as a continuum. I mean, both administrations can claim partial credit. I mean, the original intelligence was done from interrogations that were conducted while Bush was still in office.
Back in 2007.
Right. And it's a long trail. But there are a couple of things that Obama did do. He, you know, Bush had become so distracted, I think, by the Iraq War and the fact that there was nothing but cold leads with Osama bin Laden, that he disbanded the group, the cell that was devoted strictly to trying to find him. Obama, as I recall, put that cell back together. And what might have had some impact was more than doubled the drone strikes in the sanctuaries. Now, why is Osama bin Laden sitting in a city way away from the tribal areas where these drone strikes are killing lots of very senior guys? Because he's probably afraid that if he was in that area moving around, which would have been the other...
He's more in reach.
He's more in reach. So that might have been why he felt he had to sort of hunker down in this place. And if you hunker down in one place for too long, the people who are hunting you can sometimes get you.
Let's go to Frank in Washington, D.C. Frank, you've joined the Diane Rehm Show, and you have a question, I think, about Libya.
Yes. In stating that the United Nations Security Council asked the NATO to intervene, to do everything, take all measures to protect civilians, NATO's action sort of contradicts that, in my opinion. Firstly, the most prominent one by killing Gaddafi's son and his grandchildren, and then two, I think NATO sort of let its ambitions get ahead of its practical and planning time. Firstly, by declaring support for the rebels, you're choosing sides. You're no longer an impartial peacekeeper or even protecting civilians by choosing sides, choosing the rebels. NATO's gone in on one side of the equation, and thus Gaddafi has no choice but to defend himself. Now, I am an anti-Gaddafi person for his actions in Sierra Leone, West Africa, vis-a-vis Liberia, so I have no reason to defend him. But here, I think it's a question of international law and fairness.
And perhaps also, Frank, of international effectiveness, when you raised the question there of NATO's mission and whether it had been effective, there was a lot of nodding heads here in the studio. Jill, what did you make of Frank's comments?
You know, Frank brought up classic right from the beginning. This is what people have been saying about the NATO mission, that there is a lack of clarity. Yes, you want to defend civilians, but how do you do that? I mean, in defending them, do you have to help the guys who are going after Gaddafi? I mean, it's almost a tautology. You you could say, well, the person who's ultimately directing this operation is Gaddafi, ergo we ought to go after him.
And the killing of Gaddafi's grandson and son, I think it was this week, James.
But they can defend that. NATO can say, look, we weren't going after him specifically. He happened to be there where we had a command and control target. Sorry, he's dead.
I think that's their excuse, that they're going after command and control node. But they clearly I said, and many others said at the beginning of this was designed for mission creep, because your goal, getting rid of Gaddafi, was not matched by your UN sort of sanction, and it wasn't matched by your ambition in terms of a no-fly zone and protecting civilians. So they're stuck with the situation. They came in, the comment's exactly right. We came in on one side of a civil war, and that civil war is stalemated, and we are now going to have to, you'll see us, that slippery slope's going to get constantly slippier. There will be, at some point, arms to the rebels. I mean, we cannot sort of back out, and your listener is exactly right. NATO's thinking on this it was not very clear about what would be required to achieve your strategic goals here, and now they're caught on that dilemma, and they're having to get farther in and farther in, and that will happen until he's gone.
A big mess. Let's talk a little bit about Fatah and Hamas, who this week formalized a deal for unity. It comes, of course, after 4 years of being at each other's throats. Abdurrahim, the Israelis, or rather specifically Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, said that what happened was a mortal blow to peace and a great victory for terrorism, he called it. Why did he say that? Is he right? And does this deal stick?
Well, I mean, from his point of view, the accord between Fatah and Hamas is...
I should back up a little bit. Fatah and Hamas, of course, the two branches of the Palestinian movement who have been at loggerheads in Gaza and the West Bank.
Absolutely, in the West Bank. I mean, he says that this accord between Fatah and Hamas is a blow to the peace process. The Palestinians say that the position he has taken on the issue of settlements in the West Bank has been a mortal blow to the peace process. But I think within the Palestinian parameter itself, it's just part of the dynamics, the new dynamics in the region, and the new dynamics in the region have put both Hamas in Gaza and Fatah in the West Bank under increasing pressure to patch things up, to end the division between them, because a lot of Palestinians and Arabs at large are going around saying that division has been mortal to the Palestinian cause, and something has to be done about it. We have now the issue of the Palestinians going to the United Nations in September, and the hope both on the Hamas side and on the Fatah side is that in preparing for that, they have to pull together. The important factor, though, the crucial factor, is Egypt. The toppling of Mubarak has changed the dynamics in such a way that the Egyptian government now is openly backing the patching up and actually embracing the position of Hamas, not to the extent that Hamas doesn't want to recognize Israel or wants to destroy it, but in terms of fighting for a Palestinian state on the 1967 border in the West Bank and Gaza. The Egyptians are unequivocal about that.
Yeah, and I thought it was interesting that, of course, this agreement was actually signed in Cairo this week. It did tell us something about the direction of the new Egyptian government. And James, Israel, of course, watching all of this extremely carefully, what's been happening in Egypt, what is happening between Hamas and Fatah. There have been critics who have said that Netanyahu's comments, and they were very strong, were overblown and perhaps not helpful. Do you think that he was over-egging this one, or is he right that this is a great prize for terrorism?
In all of the Arab Spring, especially if you're an American and concerned about Israel's security, is the sort of not the silver lining, but the sort of gloomy lining of this is Israel's increased isolation, and there is no peace process to derail, and that's Netanyahu's problem.
Right.
It's been stalemated, and it's been largely stalemated because he will not rein in his own settlement movement, and because of that, Israel is increasingly going to be put in position. We saw it with Turkey breaking relations. We saw it now with Egypt. all of its former friends in the region are increasingly going to be looking at Israel and saying, you have got to change. You have got to find a solution to the occupation of the West Bank and the blockade of Gaza. And it, until Israel sort of sees that, and I know the Obama administration is telling the same thing, and until they get off where they are now and digging their heels in, they're going to be increasingly isolated, and we're going to increasingly have to come to their defense like we did with the 14-1 UN Security Council resolution earlier this year, where we were the only country in the world, not France, not Germany, not all our closest allies, who stopped the resolution condemning them for the blockade of Gaza. You know, they are becoming isolated. We are becoming more isolated in their defense. And the status quo, as we're seeing with this deal, is just not sustainable. So hopefully it'll be a wake-up call for Israel. Netanyahu is coming to Washington later this month. He's going to have an address to Congress. You know, his ambassador here is saying some things that lead you to believe that they are starting to recognize that this status quo is not sustainable. But let's hear what the ideas are going to put on the table.
Well, Jill, that's going to be a very interesting visit by Netanyahu here. And of course, Obama administration having had a very difficult relationship with the Israelis. Do you think there's any chance now that there's going to be some kind of moment between the two countries where they can be clear about what is in both countries' best interests in that region?
It's been back and forth for so long, I'm not quite sure. I mean, President Obama was planning some type of major address. That seems to be put back. And if you look at what Clinton and others are saying about this rapprochement or the reconciliation between Hamas and Fatah, they're just saying, we're waiting to see the details. What is this going to entail? She did not actually close the door to negotiating with Hamas, which is significant. But they put out the same demands, you know, about nonviolence recognition of Israel. So I think they're stuck in a way in how to deal exactly with this.
Well, we'll be watching that visit. Of course, when it happens, we'll be reporting on that as well. It's been an extremely busy hour. I didn't get to Bahrain. I didn't get to Haiti, but we did cover an awful lot. Jill Doherty of CNN, foreign affairs correspondent. James Kitfield, senior correspondent for National Journal magazine. Abdurrahim Fukara, Washington bureau chief for Al Jazeera Arabic. It's been a fascinating hour. I wish we could have gone on for longer. Thank you all so much for joining me.
It's great to be with you.
I'm Katty Kay of the BBC. I've been sitting in for Diane Rehm. Thanks so much for listening, all of you. Have a great weekend.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Susan Neighbors, Denise Couture, Monique Nazareth, and Sarah Ashworth. The engineer is Aaron Stamper. Dori Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives, transcripts, podcasts, and CD sales. Call 202-885-1200 for more information.